content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue the article we began in our last program titled First in the House by Bobby J. Donaldson. Born enslaved, Joseph Rainey of South Carolina was elected to Congress 150 years ago, but the impact of this momentous step in U.S. relations did not last long. Where we left off last week, by the time Rainey had earned a reputation for forcefully protecting the fledgling democracy in the South. Yet he was concerned enough about violent retaliation that he bought a second home in Windsor, Connecticut, and his wife and children moved there in the summer of 1874. Even so, in a February 1875 speech, Rainey made it clear that black politicians were not going anywhere. "We do not intend to be driven to the frontier as you have driven the Indians," said Rainey, who was also a member of the House Indian Affairs Acts Committee and a champion of Indian rights. "Our purpose is to remain in your midst as an integral part of the body politic." After Democrats gaining control of the House in the 1874 election, Republican sponsors rushed to pass the Civil Rights Bill. To gain votes, they removed the integration of schools and churches, the places that drew the fiercest opposition. Personal testimonies from African American members of Congress and sympathy for the departed Sumner helped give it traction. And on March 1, 1875, President Grant signed the Civil Rights Act. It was the final Reconstruction Act. Disgruntled Southern Democrats were already making plans to reverse the progress. Hamburg, South Carolina, lies across the Savannah River, along the Savannah River, across from Augusta, Georgia. By 1876, newly freed African Americans had revitalized the declining town, making it a haven of business and property ownership and electoral freedom. The town militia protected Hamburg from ex-Confederate vigilante raids. On July 4th of that year, 16 months after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, white travelers provoked a confrontation by attempting to drive a carriage through the African American militia's Independence Day parade on Main Street. After trying to force the militia to disband and surrender its weapons in court, one of the white travelers returned on the day of the hearing with more than 200 men and a cannon. The vigilantes surrounded the militia in a warehouse, shot men as they tried to escape, captured the rest, and tortured and executed six. Not one person was ever prosecuted for the murders. In Congress, Joseph Rainey said the assassination of Hamburg leaders was a cold-blooded atrocity. He implored his fellow members, "In the name of my race and my people, in the name of humanity, in the name of God, I ask you whether we are able to be American citizens with all the rights and immunities of citizens, or whether we are to be vassals and slaves again. I ask you to tell us whether these things are to go on." Instead, the massacre inspired a wave of open terror against African Americans across the state. In the 1876 gubernatorial race, Wade Hampton III, who had succeeded Jeb Stuart as a Confederate cavalry commander, reportedly won the election. But the tally made no mathematical sense. Of 184,000 eligible male voters, more than 110,000 were African American. Hampton had allegedly tallied more than 92,000 votes, which would have required 18,000 African Americans to choose a Confederate leader who had enslaved hundreds of people in South Carolina and Mississippi. A single county, Edgefield, reported 2,000 more votes than it had eligible voters. The federal government did nothing in response to this flagrant abuse of the polls. In fact, its inaction was part of a secret deal. In the 1876 presidential election, the Electoral College tally came down to three states, and with both parties accused each other of fraud: South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. In January 1877, just 2 months before the new president was supposed to take office, there was still no clear winner. The two parties made a compromise in private. The Democrats would allow Rutherford B. Hayes, the Ohio Republican, to become the next president of the United States. In return, his administration would allow white Democratic redeemers to reclaim their states from African Americans, however they saw fit. In essence, Northern Republicans agreed to take the presidency in exchange for withdrawing federal troops from the South, ending Reconstruction. As Rainey campaigned for re-election in 1878, he met with President Hayes. He was joined by Stephen Swales, a free-born African-American from the North who had served as an officer in the Civil War. Together, Rainey and Swales pleaded with the president to ensure fair elections. In keeping with the compromise, the president declined. When votes came in, the official count showed that John Smythe Richardson, a former Confederate officer and a Democrat, has somehow won 62% of the vote for Rainey's seat, a strong Republican district where African Americans were the majority of residents. Years later, Southern Democratic leaders boasted about all kinds of illegal acts during the elections of the 1870s, from folding more than one tissue ballot inside regular paper ballots to bringing Georgians across state lines to vote in South Carolina. In his successful 1890 campaign for governor, Benjamin Pitchfork Tillman, leader of the Red Shirts at Hamburg, brazenly referred to the massacre. The leading white men of Edgefield had wanted to seize the first opportunity that the Negro might offer them to provoke a riot and teach the Negroes a lesson. He added, "As white men, we are not sorry for it, and we do not propose to apologize for anything we have done in connection with it. We took the government away from them in 1876. We did take it." On March 3, 1879, Rainey gave his final remarks to the U.S. House of Representatives. "I was legally elected," he declared, "but was defrauded and tissued out of my seat." He asked his colleagues, "Must the will of majority rule, the very foundation and cornerstone of this republic, be supplanted, suppressed, or crushed by armed mobs of one party destroying the ballots of the other by violence and fraud?" As he prepared to leave office, Rainey told Congress he hoped an impartial historian would tell the truth about his era. 2 months later, in Nashville, Tennessee, Rainey addressed the National Conference of Colored Men with grim realism. "We may never hold another conference," he told them. "The same faces will never be mirrored against these walls," he warned. "We are a proscribed people. We have stood a great deal. We want to say that the white people, the time has come for us to give warning that we have stood all we can. We have been enriching the white man, and the time has come when forbearance has ceased to be a virtue. We have stood too much now, and I would not blame any colored man who would advise his people to flee from the oppressors to the land of freedom." Decades ahead of the great migration of the World War I era, the conference established a committee to explore conditions for a mass exodus to the western and northern United States. The new America that Rainey had hoped to help create was a fading dream. In 1883, in an 8-1 decision, the Supreme Court ruled the key sections of the Civil Rights Act were unconstitutional. The majority of opinion declared the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause only prohibited discrimination by state and local government, not by private individuals and organizations. Furthermore, the court ruled the 13th Amendment had ended slavery but did not make any guarantees against racial discrimination. With diminishing resources and in poor health, Rainey returned to Georgetown, South Carolina, where his wife opened a millinery shop. At the age of 55, he contracted malaria and died less than a year later, in August 1877. The Washington Evening Star described him as one of the most intelligent representatives of the colored race in the South. Months later, a Georgia newspaper noted the Reconstruction politicians were glimmering into obscurity. The reporter ignored all the violence and fraud, claiming that the African American had dismissed politics from his mind and gone to making money. He is too busy to vote. With black voters stripped of power, white politicians gathered to discuss the Negro question. At these meetings, there was little consideration of the African Americans who had held office during Reconstruction or the millions of new citizens they had represented. The whole era from 1868 to 1876 was recast as an effort that had failed because black voters weren't capable of making good decisions. In 1890, Hayes, no longer president, spoke to an all-white gathering at Lake Mohonk, New York, and gave voice to a malignant belief that was all too common. One of the devoted friends of the colored people tells us that their ignorance, indifference, indolence, shiftlessness, superstition, and low tone of morality are prodigious hindrances to the development of the great low country where they swarm. It is perhaps safe to conclude that half of the colored population of the South still lack the thrift, the education, the morality, and the religion required to make a prosperous and intelligent citizenship. Prominent academics would amplify and even justify this derogatory depiction of 19th century African American voters and politicians. William Archibald Dunning, a historian and political scientist at Columbia University, worked with graduate students to write state-by-state histories of Reconstruction. Writing in the Atlantic Monthly, Dunning denigrated the era's African American politicians as very frequently of a type which acquired and practiced the tricks and knavery rather than the useful art of politics. The vicious courses of those Negroes strongly confirmed the prejudices of the whites. John Schreiner Reynolds, who has been influenced by Dunning, lambasted African American leaders in his 1905 book Reconstruction in South Carolina. He called one of those leaders a vicious and mouthy Negro who lost no opportunities to inflame the Negroes against the whites. As Reynolds told it, the red shirt violence at Hamburg was the culmination of troubles that had long been brewing in the all-around Negro-ridden town. The actual lives and contributions of African-American politicians were entirely missing from establishment histories. At the American Historical Association meeting in 1909, W.E.B. Du Bois tried to correct this with a presentation called Reconstruction and Its Benefits. "There is danger today," Du Bois warned, "that between the intense feeling of the South and the conciliatory spirit of the North, grave injustice will be done the Negro American in the history of Reconstruction." But the determined effort to recast Reconstruction as a debacle of corruption continued. In 1915, Woodrow Wilson showed Birth of a Nation at the White House. The revisionist film grossly demeaned Reconstruction and inspired the revival of the Ku Klux Klan as a nationwide terrorism organization. Du Bois made another attempt to set the record straight in his 1935 book, Black Reconstruction in America, a history of the part which black folk played in the attempt to reconstruct democracy in America, 1860 through 1880. In that bold work, he explicitly described the contributions black leaders had made to American politics. Rainey of South Carolina was one of the first Americans to demand national aid for education, he noted. In 1940, not long after Gone with the Wind premiered in theaters, South Carolina erected a statue of Tillman, the former governor, U.S. senator, and violent red shirt leader, near the entry to the South Carolina State House. The goal: remind South Carolina that Tillman had believed in the inevitable triumph of white democracy. At the dedication, the keynote speaker was Senator James Burns, soon to serve as U.S. Supreme Court Justice. Burns praised Tillman for redeeming the state from black majority rule, saying, "He participated in the Hamburg and Ellenton riots of 1876 and aided in the Democratic triumph of that year by frightening prospective Negro voters away from the polls." But Rainey and his contemporaries hadn't been erased completely. In 1946, the Southern Negro Youth Congress, a decade-old political organization, gathered in the state capital, Columbia, to prepare for W.E.B. Du Bois' keynote speech. The young organizers decorated the hall's upper level with six-foot-tall portraits of African-American representatives from that era. Joseph Rainey was among them. Rainey's children and grandchildren continued his work, serving in leadership roles with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which was founded in 1909. Joseph's daughter, Olive, used to lift young Lorna Rainey onto her lap and tell stories about the congressman. "Maybe my great aunt knew that this would always be a story that's always timely," Lorna recalls today. "This is not a black story or a white story. This is a story of inspiration, of courage, of forward thinking." Lorna, a talent agent based in New York, is now working on a documentary film about Rainey, drawing on new scholarship as well as the wealth of knowledge his family handed down about him. The film, called Slave in the House, will celebrate Rainey's personal acts of bravery as well as his political legacy. He was a courageous man, Lorna says, describing how Rainey once refused to leave a hotel dining room that wouldn't serve him until escorts pushed him down the stairs. He deliberately put his physical self in harm's way in order to prove a point, and he knew that regardless of what he said, "Oh, I'm a congressman," that wasn't going to help him. They didn't see congressman. They saw color. So he didn't mind if he was threatened by the KKK or the red shirts. That couldn't stop him from trying to exercise his position to try to help other people. Unlike Lorna, Representative Clyburn learned little about Rainey's life and career when he was growing up. "No one really talked about Rainey," says Clyburn, who was born in Sumter, South Carolina in 1940. He began learning more about Rainey once he was elected to Congress in 1992, representing part of Rainey's former district. Since then, he's become a vocal advocate for remembering Rainey and the whole generation of Black Reconstruction politicians. "If people knew this history," Clyburn says, "they would have a better understanding of some of the political challenges we face today." Clyburn's career has followed a different trajectory from Rainey's. He's serving his 14th term in Congress, where he is the third highest-ranking Democrat. Through 20th-century Black activism, the Democratic Party, which once barred Black members throughout the South, became the party of civil rights under President Lyndon Johnson. From 1999 to 2001, Clyburn chaired the Congressional Black Caucus, founded in 1971. While Rainey's own career was obstructed by white supremacists and ultimately cut short, Clyburn believes that Rainey's story is ultimately one of victory. "People who pave the road often get punished," Clyburn says. "I really believe he smashed through, and there emerged a deliberate attempt was not to give him the recognition he was due. People who are first sometimes pay a real big price." Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section, music, titled "Coda for the Kid" by Jim Bouguez. His pioneering trombone work put New Orleans jazz on the map, but only now is Kid Ory getting the encore he deserves. If you were sauntering through the packed dirt streets of the back of town New Orleans in the 1910s, anywhere between Storyville and Gert Town, chances are you would have encountered several brass bands blowing a new flavor of music from wagons that promoted upcoming performances. But none of them blew like Kid Ory's band. Ory wowed onlookers by stretching his trombone slide over the tailgate and blasting competing groups with his signature goodbye tune, "Do What Ory Say," as the crowd cheered. Kid Ory's band would cut all of the bands during his tailgate advertising, Louis Armstrong marveled in a 1970 interview. The origins of jazz have always been murky. While the early 1900s band leader and cornetist Buddy Bolden is often credited with pioneering the hot improvisational brass music that became jazz, Ory is largely remembered as a sideman for stars like Louis Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton. His status as one of the most pivotal band leaders in jazz, which helped popularize the trombone glissando, a central element of New Orleans jazz, has receded from the popular memory. Yet it was Ory who prepared the ground for the work of nearly all subsequent New Orleans jazz musicians, and who arguably brought jazz into its modern form through his charismatic, innovative playing and his dogged, business-minded band leading. "Remembering Ory as a mere sideman," says John McCusker, author of the 2012 biography of Kid Ory, Creole Trombone, "is like talking about Duke Ellington as a pianist. Ory's instrument really was the band." But jazz's greatest glissandeur is now being remembered more fully. For the first time, the public can now visit Woodland Plantation in La Place, Louisiana, the former 1,882-acre sugarcane operation, 20 miles up the Mississippi River from New Orleans, where Edward Kid Ory was born to Ozame Ory and Octavie Devison on Christmas Day, 1886. As it happened, Ory's childhood home was also where the largest uprising of enslaved people in the U.S. history originated, the famous Revolt of 1811. Young Ory, who lived in the estate's former slave quarters with his parents and siblings, had a deep interest in music, and before he picked up an instrument, he and his friends would sing in quartets. We would stand on a bridge at night and hum different tunes with different harmonies, Ori recalled. It was dark and no one could see us, but people could hear us singing and they'd bring us a few ginger cakes and some water. It was good ear training. Inspired by the brass bands that performed at settlements up and down the river, Ori and his friends began playing on homemade cigar box guitars, banjos, violins, and a soapbox bass strung with fishing line and metal wire. On occasion, while attending a brass band concert, he would pick up an unused trombone while a group was on break and start working out its mysteries. After he made serious money in 1905, likely from that year's sugarcane harvest, Ori traveled to Orleans for music in New Orleans and paid $67 for his first trombone, nearly $2,000 in today's money. It was a shorter model with valves like those on a trumpet instead of the longer slide that would soon become synonymous with New Orleans jazz. With the instrument in hand, he stopped by his sister's house near Jackson Avenue, which happened to be a popular musician's hangout. Buddy Bolden walked by and heard Ori play. "I was running over the horn and he stopped and rapped on the door," Ori recalled in a 1957 interview. Bolden offered him a job on the spot. Though tempted, Ori couldn't move to New Orleans. He promised his parents before they died that he would stay in Laplace to take care of his younger sisters. Still, he and his bandmates, by 1911 they were known simply as Kid Ori's Band, began making regular trips to the Crescent City. They had befriended and learned from Bolden's group, whose loose improvisational style was described as hot, as opposed to other brass bands that played sheet music, including Bolden's rival, John Robichaud. Ori saw how Bolden had adapted his style of playing from holy roller churches, where attendees danced, clapped, and moved however the spirit directed them. But to Ori, Bolden played too loud and too brash, while Robichaud was far too formal. "Bolden was very rough," said Ori. "You have to give him credit for starting the ball rolling. But he really wasn't a musician. He was a gifted player with effect but no tone." So Ori went about creating music that balanced Bolden's brashness with Robichaud's professionalism. Ori realized that the way to get good jobs and get the money, get the jobs with the white folks, was to show up, look good, be on time, do all the stuff that John Robichaud did to lock up that white audience, but play the hot stuff, says McCusker. Ori would show other musicians in New Orleans how to make a living playing hot music. When Ori permanently moved his six-piece band to New Orleans in 1910, he had a new weapon, which became a defining part of his sound, a slide trombone. As you can hear on the 1922 hit Ori's Creole Trombone and innumerable other songs throughout his catalog, the slide enabled him to play glissando and smear between notes, which gave his music the boozy sound still associated with New Orleans jazz. Ori was not the first to play a glissando on a trombone, but he was surely one of the most dazzling and influential. In 1913, a teenage Armstrong began showing up at Ori's performances, much as Ori had followed Bolden's shows 8 years earlier, and earned a spot in Ori's band playing cornet in 1918. With the prohibition of alcohol in Louisiana in 1919, preceded by enforcement of the Wartime Prohibition Act in 1918, and the closing of the Storyville Red Light District in 1917, changed the landscape for jazz musicians in New Orleans. Moving to Los Angeles, where the police seemed less determined to crack down on nightclubs, Ori made history. In 1922, he recorded Ori's Creole Trombone with a new band he'd assembled of fellow displaced New Orleanians. It was the first jazz recording made by black musicians from New Orleans. And it's an ensemble piece from beginning to end, a burst of polyphony rather than a band supporting a soloist, with Ori's glissando touches delivering the hook. The tune offers a rare glimpse into the origins of New Orleans jazz and remarkable insight to this music's durability and universal appeal. David Sager, a musician and jazz historian, said in 2005, when the Library of Congress selected the song for the National Recording Registry, which recognizes exemplars of the nation's musical heritage, "The song was among half a dozen Ori recordings on three RPMs released at once. The entire first pressing of 5,000 records sold out and gave Ori a new audience. Today, an original copy of Ori's Creole Trombone fetches $1,000. The tune and its style of instrumentation inspired groups across the country and ushered Ori and his signature sound into the Hollywood party circuit while also furnishing gigs down the coast in San Diego and Tijuana. Following invitations from Armstrong, Morton, and Joseph King Oliver, in 1925, Ori moved to Chicago, where jazz had really taken off. Ori recorded sides with Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five and gigged across Chicago for a couple of years, including at mob haunts like The Plantation, where he rubbed shoulders with Al Capone. But recording opportunities slowed in the late 1920s, and the trend toward big band swing arrangements didn't favor the music Ori had spent the previous decade and a half playing. He returned to Los Angeles just before the stock market crash of 1929. Paying gigs were scarce in the Great Depression, and in 1933, one of the most important American musicians of the early 20th century put down his trombone and picked up a mop working as a janitor for the Santa Fe Railway. The 1940s, jazz fans, turned off by the less danceable bebop style gaining popularity, brought New Orleans jazz back into vogue. Crucially, in 1942, Ori received $8,000 in back royalties for Muskrat Ramble, a tune he'd written and recorded with Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five in 1926. Ori's friend and fellow jazz man, Barney Bigard, who had experience dealing with rights and royalties, helped him track down the publisher. The windfall helped him ease back into the Los Angeles music scene. Ori's new sextet, based on his classical-era bands, dazzled critics and fans, including Orson Welles, who hired Ori to lead the band on his CBS radio show, The Orson Welles Almanac, in 1944. Music writers rhapsodized about Ori's comeback, the most important event of 1945 in jazz, speaking of public rather than recorded performance, is the extended run of Kid Ory's band in Hollywood. Rudy Blesch wrote in the Jazz Record in October 1945, Ori is the Ori of old. He is an artist, the greatest trombone of all time. Ori continued to perform in Los Angeles clubs until retiring in 1966. He visited New Orleans one last time in 1971 to perform at the second annual New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, which now attracts 500,000 people at the city each spring. He died of pneumonia in 1973 at age 86 in Honolulu. More than a century after his birth, the world Ori grew up isn't hard to spot if you know where to look. Neighborhood of modest wood frame and mobile homes called Woodland Quarter sits on the site of the former slave dwellings where Ori lived as a boy in Louisiana. Across U.S. Highway 61, green stalks of ripe sugarcane tower 6 feet high in fields that had once been part of the plantation. The derelict buildings around the corner from Woodland on Laplace's Main Street are what's left of the overseer's house and the warehouse for the plantation store, where Ori once ordered a banjo. And on the wall of the barn behind the house, a stark reminder of the world Ori escaped remains crudely painted on the wall. Notice, no loafers allowed in here. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.